This is session, this is class 2, session 12, our last session. We're working on knowledge, and nowadays, as you've noticed, I'm sure, there's a lot of talk in the readings, especially the TSK readings, but also actually the readings we did from Knowledge of Time and Space, about great knowledge. So we're trying to get a handle on this notion, and the reading that we're doing from Knowledge of Time and Space this week closely links great knowledge with the body of knowledge. I think we've probably mentioned this before, but the way that Knowledge of Time and Space is set up is that it groups chapters into these sections of typically three chapters to a section, and this section is on the body of knowledge. So that really is our theme. And that's in large part what we'll be talking about today. So the term body of knowledge is kind of a term of art in TSK. We came across it last week, so it was mentioned in the TSK book. The way it's used in Knowledge of Time and Space, I think, is very similar, although it starts off differently. But we'll talk about that in a moment. The main point to make, I think, about the body of knowledge, and this is clear in the reading, but I want to point to some places where it's made very clear, is that it is, when we talk about the body of knowledge, we are not exactly talking about our ordinary body. You know, we're not talking about embodiment in the ordinary sense. Let's see, I see a note here that I'm being asked to speak up. Is it okay now? I'm in a funny setup here, so I'm not sure everything's working right. I'm trying to change things around. If this is still not okay, let me know. Okay, so the body of knowledge does not involve our usual sense of a body, and it doesn't even involve the way we use the term in English typically, where we might say that, a doctor has to master a certain body of knowledge. That's not really the way we're talking about it, at least mostly, in this chapter. The nature of the body of knowledge, you know, if we get clear about that, then we'll kind of be clear about what great knowledge is about also. So let me point to a couple of places where the text says that. On page 443, which is in the first chapter, it's talking in the first full paragraph about the body of knowledge. And first of all, it says that it's indestructible and brilliant. So we know we're not talking about our ordinary knowledge. But then it says, in the body of knowledge, there's no impermanence, no transitions, no knower and no known. There is not even embodiment of knowledge within an ordinary realm. And it goes on, it says, creation lives in the uncreated. So we're talking about body of knowledge in a, you know, rather specific sense, and we'll try to get clear about that. Just to cite one more place, on 445, the text says, I think we'll return to this paragraph, well, we'll return to this page later, but in the first paragraph of this second chapter, it says, not bound by here or by this, the body of knowledge is no body at all. So again, it's not the way we ordinarily think of embodiment. So we want to try to kind of, we want to get a sense of what that means. In one way, you know, people, when we talk about TSK, people often say, you know, they have difficulty getting into it because it seems so abstract and intellectual and theoretical. And often people say, we would like to find ways to make TSK more embodied. So here we are, talking about embodiment. And as we'll see, that's actually very concrete, what he has to say here. But at the same time, he's saying, yeah, embodiment, but it's not our ordinary embodiment. It's not a body at all. So it sounds like we're right back out into the world of abstraction. So we need to reconcile that. I think it is important to bring embodiment into TSK, and I think that this chapter, or the readings for this week, do that. But at the same time, it's a kind of special TSK embodiment. We need to understand what that is. So I saw a talk online by a Buddhist teacher within the last week where he cited something from a Buddhist sutra that I think actually is helpful here. Of course, he's not talking about the body of knowledge. He's talking about the mind. And for our purposes, that will do. The mind, is, of course, plays a very central role. And even some of the discussion here when it talks about body of knowledge is related to the mind. So the passage that I'm thinking of that I heard was a reference to a sutra, and he didn't identify the sutra, but he said the sutra brings out three levels of mind. And so the first one is mind, the second one is no mind, and the third one is clarity. And I think you could compare that to what is talked about here in terms of the body of knowledge. First you talk about embodiment, you could say, and then you say, but you know, it's not really embodiment. there isn't a body. That's what we were just looking at. And then the third level is this level of clarity, and that really brings in the knowledge. And I think it's very, very much related to what we've been talking about. Actually, if we look back, and I don't have the reference here, but if we look back at last week's reading, at a certain point in the TSK book, Rinpoche makes exactly, or it seems like, the same distinction. He says, in great knowledge, we are no longer talking about mind and things, we're talking about clarity. So I think that's a very good way to get into this, to say what the body of knowledge offers is a knowledge that is, well, I don't have a better word than clarity. Let's just stay with that right now. And we'll try to get more clear about it as we go along. So we're moving to a different level, but that doesn't mean we're leaving the other levels behind. You know, we do still have a body. We do still, there is still a, you could say, a body of knowledge in the same sense. But we move into a different kind of knowledge, which is based on clarity rather than on mind and the things that are available to a mind to know. Now, I want to step aside, go in a little bit different direction for a moment, because the fact that I cite a Buddhist sutra, for me it raised the question that people ask so often about the relationship between TSK and Buddhism, especially sort of what people think of as the highest teachings of Buddhism. I think this actually is a good place to discuss that for a moment, so I want to do that. You could say, so why would we want to bring in a Buddhist text as a way of understanding what the body of knowledge is in TSK? Does that mean that, in fact, these two different approaches can really be resolved into one, can be kind of, I don't want to say reduced, but can be seen as one? I think the answer is no. Rinpoche has said absolutely TSK is not Buddhism, so that's my starting point. I think the way to discuss that, the way to think about it, is that in TSK, you are approaching the whole realm of human possibilities in a completely different way. You're doing it, it's kind of obvious what I'm going to say, you're doing it in terms of time and space and knowledge, right? That's just not how you do things in Buddhism. So if you ask, are we really talking about Buddhism here? No, we're not. We're talking about time and space and knowledge. And that is a particular way of understanding the possibilities for being or the possibilities for human being. And, it's like saying Buddhism is one set of teachings, and TSK is a very different set of teachings, that's not really a very TSK way of saying it. Maybe you'd say Buddhism offers one vision of reality. TSK offers another vision of reality. And when you explore the TSK vision, you really are not looking at the Buddhist presentation at all. So, what the TSK vision is all about, the way it's presented. I mean, you might say, this would be one way of saying it, that the TSK vision as presented in the TSK books, in the whole series of books, is embodied. The books embody a vision, or the TSK vision, and you can't just ignore that embodiment. I mean, nobody's talking about ignoring it, I guess, but you really need to say, well, the vision finds form through the way it's presented in the books, and you could say certainly through the exercises. So you're not, it wouldn't make sense to say, well, let's go study some Buddhist texts for a while, because those will help us understand TSK. I mean, maybe at some level they would give us some insights, and the other way around has always seemed to me true, that studying TSK is helpful when you're looking at Buddhist texts, but that's not our concern here. You might ask, well, do TSK and Buddhism arrive at the same place? Is their vision the same? And maybe we don't, as students of the TSK vision, maybe we don't need to resolve that, but because we don't care as TSK students whether Buddhism has a complete vision or understanding of the nature of reality. Although I think it's hardly needs to be said, but it's not as though Rinpoche said at some point, Buddhism really doesn't go far enough, so I've developed TSK. No, he's happy with Buddhism. he's not leaving the Buddhist tradition behind. This is just a different approach. So that's a little bit of a digression. Yeah.
Is there a notion of being in Buddhism?
Well, that's interesting. The short answer is no, maybe I don't have to give you authoritative answers about Buddhism, but no, there isn't. Now, as some of you know, there was a translator who worked with Rinpoche back in the 70s, named Herbert Günther. Dharma Publishing published some of his translations. And there are terms that he likes to translate as being, because he thinks that makes sense in a Western context. But it's not a literal translation. You do not talk about being. I mean, you could talk about existence, but that becomes much more complicated. Now, there's a question from Sudhi that I've been ignoring. She says, is clarity, and then she gives a kind of definition, which I'm assuming comes from the book, I don't recognize it right now, knowing with utmost certainty. Is that almost intuitive gut knowing without doubt? Well, yes and no, I would say. I mean, the problem, anytime we say, we have a kind of intuitive knowing or a gut knowing, that's probably a good description of the kind of knowing that isn't owned by a knower that can lead us into great knowledge. I think that is a good description. The problem is that it's also a possible description for other kinds of knowing where we might have a very strong feeling saying, I just know this is right. That my gut tells me. But in fact, we are still hooked into a lower level kind of knowledge in which the self has this intuition. So it's fine as a description, but it's not adequate as a description, if that's clear. At least that's how I would respond to that question. Okay, so I wanted to use that opportunity to say something about the relationship between TSK and Buddhism, because it comes up regularly. But now I want to go back into the discussion of body of knowledge in the reading. And I'll go right back to the beginning, and then we'll set it up for practice pretty quickly. The start of this chapter, the first chapter in the reading that we have from Knowledge of Time and Space, talks about a body of knowledge in a lower level way. So it's kind of convenient to be able to talk about lower level and higher level and so on. And I don't usually do that, because I think that way of making distinctions is a little bit contrary to what the TSK vision does, but it does talk that way sometimes. So it does make things easy. I mean, it's kind of a good communication tool, as long as you don't take it so seriously. So what he's saying is that whatever he says, every form of knowing, so let's just say ordinary knowledge, and okay, I'll stop for a moment, because Ken asks another question, which I think is a good and clarifying question. He says, does clarity, which we've been talking about so far, resist being hooked into? And I think that's a nice description. Yeah, you can't take hold of clarity. Remember that the word concept, we've mentioned this before, really means something. It's a way of taking hold of something. Literally, that's what the Latin for concept means. And not only conceptually, but in other ways, maybe in terms of gut intuition. I don't know if that's what inspired your question, Ken, but you know, whenever we take hold of it and say, this is what it is, then we are kind of dimming down the radiance of clarity. So yes, it does resist. There's where we need to get with great knowledge is to a place where there's nothing to get, there's nothing to understand, there's nothing to arrive at. It's just a kind of natural dimension of being. We'll look at that. I'm anticipating here. So whenever you think you've gotten something, I think I'm quoting some Buddhist text now, but whenever you think you've gotten something, you can be sure that that's not it, because there is no it to get. Okay, so let's go back to this body of knowledge. In the beginning of this chapter, Rinpoche talks about the body of knowledge in a lower level way, the range, he says, of the known and the knowable. And he says that there's, in any particular body of knowledge, there are things that can't be known. So it's like, it's like if you talk about a discipline, I used the example of a doctor earlier, there's a body of knowledge that goes with any academic discipline, let's say, so biology or political science or whatever it is. And so that within that discipline, within that body of knowledge, there are certain questions you can ask, and there are other questions you can't ask. So the way Rinpoche goes into that, and I think this then becomes is helpful for us, he says that because you're going to come up against limits whenever you engage a body of knowledge in this more limited sense, not the body of knowledge, in English we get to capitalize the body of knowledge, and that makes it different from lowercase body of knowledge. I know in German you can't do that, but I suppose you could find other ways to make the distinction. So we're not talking about big B, big K body of knowledge. We're talking about this lower level body of knowledge. And the point Rinpoche is making is that there are limitations in the body of knowledge, in any given body of knowledge. And the way that those limitations show up are at points of unknowing and paradox. I'm quoting from the beginning of the second paragraph on page 440. So the theme of unknowing is one that we practiced in the exercise for this week, exercise 23B from Dynamics, which is about going into the unknowing. You might say that what's being referred to here, he doesn't really go into it, is a kind of a lower level unknowing. I'm not sure. I wouldn't necessarily insist on that. I want to focus more on paradox, although I guess you could think of it as unknowing also, because he goes on to give examples. He says, when you arrive at a paradox or a limit or something that's not known, that can be a gateway to greater knowledge. How can it be a gateway to greater knowledge? It shows us that our ordinary knowledge is limited and that we could engage that knowledge differently. We could engage it with a different relationship to time and space. So let me stop there for a moment because Michael has a question. He asks, are the obscurations to clarity entirely on the side of our perception and understanding, or is clarity dimmed and obscured in the field itself, in the entire realm in which we live? And then he asks, he goes on, if the body of knowledge is essentially an embodiment of clarity, would it be possible for us to be clear in our being by virtue of appreciation and presence? Or do these questions reflect a mistaken separation into subject and object and the distance between them? Okay, those are a good set of questions. I think that the possibility that you raise in the third question, I think that is roughly how I would approach the first question. So in the first question you say, is it a question of our lack of clarity, or is it that the whole field, the realm in which we live, is characterized by a lack of clarity? And I think the answer to that is that you really can't separate the two. Our way of being cannot be separated from the field in which we live. We live in a field in which we have a particular way of being and of knowing. Right? So the subject is not separate from the field or the world that it inhabits. And Ron comments here, maybe the latter, I think, kind of making the same point, who becomes clear? And that's a way of saying it. It's not a question of saying we can become more clear without changing the field. The two go together. Now, the second question you raised, Michael, there's a lot in your questions here, is asking, could we be clear in our being by virtue of appreciation and presence? And that goes to a larger question that we'll explore in this phone call, and I'm sure in others too. How do we engage the body of knowledge, or how do we, different ways to say it, how can we tune into it, or how can it become active? And yes, appreciation and yes, presence, those are very effective ways to do it. So, okay. So we're still on this first page and the second paragraph. And then Rinpoche is saying, when you arrive at a paradox or at something that's not understood, that's a sign of the limitations in operation in the body of knowledge. And I think, actually, the questions you've been asking are a nice bridge, because I've been using the example of a limited body of knowledge in relation to particular disciplines, like biology has its own body of knowledge. But it's much more important, I think, for our purposes, to say we as human beings, or Jack as Jack, and each of you as each of you, we operate with our own body of knowledge. It's a Jack body of knowledge, right? And in that body of knowledge, partly it's going to be a body of knowledge that's shared by all human beings by virtue of being human beings, or shared by all Americans by virtue of being Americans, or, you know, we belong to these different groups, and there's a body of knowledge, you could say, that goes with each one. But partly it's also going to be very personal. So we do want to be looking at, you know, how do we investigate, how do we let the limits on our own body of knowledge lead us into an appreciation for greater knowledge. And he gives this very interesting example. He has, for example, the split between body and mind and the difficulty of accounting for communication between the two. So that's a problem. That's a paradox or a lack of understanding. I'm stopping the sentence in the middle. It says, the split between body and mind and the difficulty of accounting for communication between the two. Now, that's not a problem in Jack's body of knowledge. That's a problem in you know, human beings' body of knowledge. You might say philosophy's body of knowledge, but really, when we try to make sense, we don't have to be professional philosophers, when we try to make sense of how it is that mind and body are connected to each other, it's very difficult to do. You can say, well, the two are, you know, there's a mental realm and a physical realm, but then immediately the question comes, which is the one mentioned here in the text, well, how are they connected? So, and people cannot come up with a good answer to that. I mean, you can, okay. People try. There's a lot written about this. But, you know, nobody's ever really that satisfied, I don't think. it's very difficult to find a good way of connecting the two. So then the alternative is to say, well, you don't have to connect them because they're already one. Everything is material. Everything is the body. Even the mind looks like it's separate, but it's really just the body. Well, that's also, you know, it doesn't make sense if you actually try to compare it to your own experience. Or you can say it the other way around, say everything is mind. Also, very difficult. It just doesn't match up. It's kind of paradoxical to make those claims. So that's the example that Rinpoche gives here of saying that you realize then that there's a limitation in your knowledge. And in fact, that's sometimes said about paradoxes. When you come to something that seems to lead to a paradoxical result, a result that just leads you into confusion, and it's an indication that you're asking the wrong question or basing yourself on the wrong understanding, or, as he says here, working with a limited body of knowledge. Right? So, Ron says it's materialism is problematic. All of those different views are problematic in their own ways. For those of you who are in Berkeley, I think in about 6 weeks, I'm going to be doing a presentation on this with someone else, kind of on this very question, but not exactly TSK. Okay, so that's the example he raises. This is a paradox that shows us that we are working with a limited way of being, and Sudhi says this seems to relate to coexistence. Paradox can coexist. Well, I hope, although I have my doubts, that we will get to talk about coexistence a little in this phone call. It comes up at the end of the main reading from Knowledge of Time and Space, and we'll see if we get a chance to talk about it. But yes, I think it is related to coexistence. I hadn't thought about that before, but I think you're right. But I want to go on just two things, and then that will lead us into a practice. I stopped that sentence in the middle, remember? So the part I read said, we can't understand how mind and body are connected. And then he says, that difficulty can lead us to the realization that breath is a meeting place for the physical and mental. Now this is a I think, just really striking. It was striking to me when I read it for a couple of reasons. One is, it goes back to this question that I talked about at the beginning, which is that people say, oh, we want a more embodied approach to TSK. Well, here is something that's just super embodied in an ordinary sense, right? just in an ordinary sense, we say, look at the breath, or work, not, you know, don't look at the breath, but work with the breath, right? Let the breath become the meeting place for the physical and mental. So the first point here is, if you say, well, sometimes people say to me, well, not so much in our phone calls, but like on a retreat, you know, maybe people will say, well, you know, why don't we do some kumye? You know, we need to relax, we need to get into the body. There are a couple of TSK exercises that are like this. But here's one. This is not presented as a specific exercise, but it's presented as something you could do. He says, this could lead us into a realization. That sounds like an instruction for an exercise, right? So the practice here would be to focus on the breath and let it be a meeting place for the physical and the mental. So in one way, here's a TSK exercise that's embodied in the ordinary sense of the body. We're working with the breath and the body and the mind. In another way, though, this is a great example of an exercise where you say, well, wait a minute, this isn't how I learned how to focus on the breath in Kumye, you know, or in some other meditation practice, let's say, because we're using this focus on the breath, this settling into the breath, in as a specific form of inquiry, right? So the theme of inquiry is so important, as you know, in TSK, and here's a specific form of it. If we focus on the breath, we can discover that the breath is a meeting place for the physical and the mental. And if we discover that, so, you know, it's not a conceptual discovery. It's when we're in the breath, when we're breathing in a very embodied way, let's say, the question about the relationship or communication between the body and the mind is resolved. And it's not resolved conceptually, and it's not resolved through some kind of insight that is, I mean, you could maybe say insight, yes, but it's an insight that's embodied. So it's a wonderful example, really, of what Rinpoche is presenting here in general about the body of knowledge, which is that the way to embody knowledge, the way to engage the body of knowledge is to embody knowledge, to let breathing be the knowing. And it's not just kind of a general knowing. I mean, I have nothing against general knowing, but it's not this sense of saying knowledge is available everywhere. That's good. But it's very specific. It's saying in breathing, the relationship of body and mind the puzzle, you could say, of that relationship vanishes. A different knowledge, a new knowing comes into being. So I just thought it was a very nice example. I was going to assign it as our practice I was going to have us do it during the phone call, but I experimented with it some during the week and I found it quite difficult. So I decided that we're going to do a different practice, and I do want to get us to that practice. I think it's on the next page. Rinpoche suggests another kind of embodied practice. So we'll look at that. But let me take a look at a couple of the questions here. Let's see. Ken says, the notion of readout is helpful here. So convincing, so certainly complete and true. So yes, the body of knowledge, we each have our own body of knowledge, and whatever appears within that body of knowledge seems very convincing. And you could say, yes, it's like a readout. The body of knowledge reads out a certain understanding of what's so. Right? So convincing, so certainly complete and true, and then a vanishing, a never was or could be, and then how does that operate? What knowing operates? I can never be completely sure. Why be anything? Clear about is a sort of a silly phrasing. Now, clarity. Okay, well, that's a little cryptic, Ken, but I'm going to, I think I'll mostly let it stand. Let me say something about it. It's like, yeah, it's not that I need to get clear. about something, right? It's the clarity operates. And the example we were just looking at about the breath, even though we're not going to practice with it, is an example of how clarity can operate within the body of knowledge, let's say, without being mine. Right? Michael says, Hayward says, could we say that all appearances are the body of knowledge? Is knowledge the clarity that allows appearance? Well, those are two slightly different questions. I think Rinpoche is very clear in these chapters, yes, that nothing is left out of the body of knowledge. Right? All appearances participate in the body of knowledge. I don't have a quote at hand right now, but I think that's absolutely true. And then you ask, is knowledge the clarity that allows appearance? And I think the answer to that is probably also yes, but let me make sure that we're all agreed on what you're asking. We've looked at this question before. When things appear, there is a kind of a light within which they appear, if we're thinking about visual appearance, you know. And not just like, okay, there's sunlight, but if you close your eyes and think about something, something visual, and then that image forms in your mind, there is a light that allows that image to appear. And I think that, to me, it's always made very good sense. Rinpoche brings this up in Knowledge of Freedom specifically, but in other places. It's always made very good sense to me to say, well, that light in which, let's say, inner appearance appears, that is awareness, that is knowledge. We might call it, I think he says in here somewhere, well, we might call it awareness or consciousness, but we're talking about the body of knowledge. Yeah. So, yes. Okay. And Michael asks or says, so Ron wants to know what page is that on again, but now I've lost track of. I'm just working with the first page so far. I'm not sure what you're asking, Ron, which reference. Michael says, everything is vibration, sluggish for physical, fast for mental, etc. And that resolves the split between matter and mind. Well, that would be one way of resolving it, okay. But I seem to have misplaced the vibratory body that allows me to live there. Well, I like the verb misplaced, yeah. Somehow, it all seems so clear, but somehow I can't get there or I can't find it anymore, whatever it is, yeah. And then Sudhi says, it's all explained on page 450. Well, let's try to take a look. Page 450, paragraph 1. She says everything I've been talking about, right? So this question in particular, the intimacy of space and knowledge remains active in the appearing of first-level shape and form. I think that is exactly a response to Hayward's question, could we say that all appearances are the body of knowledge, right? We have to see through their substantiality, and then we get into this question of coexistence. Well, you've brought up coexistence a couple of times now, Sudhi, and maybe I should say just a little bit about it, because I don't know I'll try to get to the exercise. Always hard to make choices. But there is a sense here of coexistence, the idea that Rinpoche has, it seems to be pointing towards when he talks about coexistence, roughly, is whatever you claim, whatever you say is so, coexists with its not being so. Right? And if we really can get get an embodied sense, let's say, of what that means, that's tremendously helpful because we no longer are making claims. You know, we're not doing a body of knowledge in the lower level sense. We're not making that kind of claim. Whatever we say coexists with the possibility or the truth of its opposite. And so an example is mind and body. any kind of opposition. And, you know, saying that, you might say, well, that takes you as far as the field of all possibilities, but it actually is pointing beyond that. I'm not going to try to say more about it right now, but what he says about coexistence, I think, is very helpful. Okay, Ron says, the reference to the breath, Ron, is right at the bottom, or six lines up from page 440. But Ron writes, clarity is already clear. Clarity is already clear. The more we as an agent think we need to make something clear, we will remain far removed from clarity. Yet even in such confusion, clarity is shining. That's true. And this is exactly one of those paradoxical statements that TSK makes. I mean, TSK loves paradox at a certain level. So the paradoxical statement is, within confusion, clarity is shining, right? Or there's no way to dim the radiance of the body of great knowledge. Those kinds of statements. And you could say, to kind of try to pull things together, we could say that's an example of the coexistence that Sudhi was pointing at. Or you could say that, maybe I don't have anything else to say about it right now. So let's leave it at that. Let's see if we can get, I know we started a little late today, let's see if we can at least point towards the practice, the second practice that I had in mind. As I said, this first practice about the breath is something very interesting to explore. I just came to the conclusion that it wouldn't be good for us to do it in the phone call, and that was mostly based on my own difficulty in really finding a good way to work with the practice. But I'm sure that it's a great practice, so I encourage you to look at it. But let's take a look at 441, and I'll at least point you towards a practice there, which maybe we'll cheat and make it the walkabout practice, because we don't have time to do more. It comes up in a context where Rinpoche talks about the limitations we discover and how we usually just accept the limitations. The reason we accept them is because what's comfortable for us is to play the role of the knower in first level time and space. And so when we accept that role, when we become the bystander, it says at the top of page 441, then we're also accepting linear time and empty space. And actually this, the paragraph that starts at the bottom of 440 is a very good example. Sometimes we look for descriptions of what the TSK vision is all about that kind of boil it down into something easy to cite to people, to quote to people, and this is a good example of a place where it's really, the relationship among lower level knowledge and time and space is spelled out very nicely here. But I want to move on. He says that on a higher level, time and space really are not separate from knowledge. He says they're equally embodiments of knowledge. I'm in the second paragraph now, right? And he has some interesting things to say there. But then in the third paragraph, there's this other practice. He says we can touch the body of knowledge, the big body of knowledge, by focusing on our embodiment directly. And here it seems that he's talking about embodiment just in a very straightforward way, somewhat the same way that in the other practice we looked at, he says, look at your breath, or not so much look at it, engage breathing, and let that become the meeting place of body and mind. Right? So here he's talking about we can focus on our embodiment with our senses attuned to the world around us, we grow aware of a more encompassing body of knowledge. So this is a very straightforward practice, you could say, in the sense that it seems to be not separate from all sorts of meditative practices. It says focus on your senses, right? Attune your senses to the world around us. But he gives some specific instructions, I think, that bring it into the TSK realm. He says, with our senses attuned to the world around us, we grow aware of a more encompassing body of knowledge. So you might say, at the least, we're challenging the limits of our conventional body of knowledge. Maybe we haven't yet arrived at the kind of great knowledge body of knowledge, but a more encompassing body of knowledge. Expanding awareness, so this is an awareness that expands by attuning the senses to the world, right? Expanding awareness aligns with the subtle energies of inner experience. So this is a little bit of a shift, or a little, you know, a suggestion of going in a certain direction. So there, you're attuned with the senses, and that attunement, that awareness, aligns with the subtle energies of inner experience. So you need to look. It's kind of inner and outer are coming together in a very specific way. You know, expanding awareness aligns with the subtle energies of inner experience. Making knowledge available, not only through the activity of senses and mind. So let's stop there. He's saying, so the first step, you might say, is attuning your senses to the environment, to the world around you. And then the second step is to see how that aligns, that awareness of the world around you aligns with your own mental energies, right? Your own inner experience. And then he says, he adds a third element. So the first element is the senses, attuning the senses. The second element is aligning that awareness with inner energies or inner experience. The third element, he says, okay, making knowledge available not only through the activity of senses and mind, but throughout the realm of physical space and linear time. So what he's suggesting, it seems to me, and again, it's remarkable, you know, that, this is not presented as a specific exercise, but you can see it'd be very easy to write it up as a fairly detailed exercise. Right? So this third level is when you become aware of the relationship between inner experience and the world revealed through the senses. So this actually points right back to what we were talking about the relationship between the physical and the mental, right? This is being very specific about that. When you become aware of that interconnection, you engage the possibility that knowledge is available not in your experience, but throughout the realm of physical space and linear time. So in effect, what you're saying is, if you drop the distinction between subject and object, right, or if not drop it exactly, bring those two together, right, you align them through an expanding awareness, then the whole notion that knowledge has to be confined to the one who's doing the knowing, that drops away too, and you discover that knowledge is available throughout the realm of physical space and linear time. In other words, in our ordinary world of limited appearances of linear time and empty space, as he says earlier on the page, knowledge is shining through that. The clarity of knowledge is available. And Ken adds, subject-object reversal is of huge help here, exclamation mark. And yes, I'm sure that would be a very good way to practice with this. And we actually worked with subject-object reversal at one point in the retreat that we held recently. And I was struck on going back to that exercise and reading the instructions that it does say something. It's actually quite similar to what's said here, which is that you let the knowing capacity, you know, we've looked at subject-object reversal before. So you let the object be the one that knows. But the exercise gives a specific instruction that says, let that knowing dimension be present, be a part of everything that manifests in your experience, not just a specific object that you've picked out across the room or whatever, but in every aspect of experience. And that's very, very similar to what's being said here. Right? So knowledge is available, one, in the activity of the senses, two, in the activity of the mind, but those two are not understood as separate. They're understood as aligned with each other. And three, throughout the realm of physical space and linear time. So there's a beautiful practice. And maybe you could set aside some time, or maybe you could try to do it actually very much the way that subject-object reversal gives the instruction and says, you can do that wherever you go. So try doing this practice wherever you go. We would have done it if we'd had time, but you know, it's very meaty material. So I'll comment on some of the material that we didn't cover in our phone call, but I think we really do have to end the phone call now. It's going to take me a day or two because I'm in the middle of some other things right now. It's going to take me a day or two to post the orientation for next week, but it will come. Okay, thank you. Well, that's very illuminating. These phone calls often, I think, help clarify for me what's going on, and I hope for you as well.